You're listening to WOOL Radio 91.5 FM from Bellows Falls, Vermont. So we've gathered a group of friends here to talk about different wines. It's an experiment that we're making for a show that could become a series called What's My Wine, and that's to be determined as we find our way. You know, we had this idea. It was just sort of a natural outgrowth of all the wonderful dinners that we've had together at various tables with some remarkably great food and always interesting wines. And that's how this conversation evolved, was just sort of a natural outgrowth of our intense interest in what kind of wines pair with the food and
friendships and
The
conversations.
Back to the concept of like what is a memorable wine? It usually has something to do with the people you're with when you drink it.
Yeah,
and the beauty of the food. Before we get into an exploration of wines from the Cahors region of France, first, let me introduce two of our good friends, Keith Zimmerman and Joe Canini, to learn about how they first became interested in wines and winemaking. Keith, how did you first get introduced to the alchemy of making wine? I mean, you have been a vintner. You understand how to make wine, and you worked at the Biltmore Estate.
I did. Actually, I'd gone to UC Davis to study winemaking.
So that's the very school that we've mentioned, like, every time we've talked about Willamette Valley or Washington State. That's the school that
spawned
this remarkable cadre of pioneers in winemaking.
That's correct. So I'd gone out there to study winemaking, but I was in love with this girl back in Asheville, North Carolina, which is where I left. And so I came back to North Carolina. The Biltmore Estates was just starting their wine program at the time. So I contacted them and asked them if they were looking for anyone. And since I was at Davis, they knew that I was serious about winemaking, so I was hired. It was really early stages. I mean, now I think they're producing the most wines, at least their tasting room. They have more people go through their tasting room than any winery in this country. It's huge. At the time, it was small. We were planting the vineyards, spent a lot of time out planting grapes. Some of the grapes had been planted. We were pruning those. Kind of cold, wet mornings.
Field out in the work.
In the morning, a vineyard. But it was really interesting to watch the people and, laying out a vineyard on a hillside where it's curved. You know, your math comes into play. So, there's calculus and it's interesting to see some of these things you've been in school for where there's these practical applications. I particularly liked the winery. That's where I really enjoyed being around the winemaker, Philippe Jourdain from Carcassonne in France. Philippe was really great. Once or twice a week, he would be the professor, spend an hour to an hour and a half teaching us about winemaking. And the great thing for him, I suppose, was that, here were these, North Carolina bumpkins that knew diddly squat about wine, and he had the opportunity to teach them the way he wanted to.
And shape it. How that vineyard was going to come to be.
There was nothing, none of us knew anything. So I helped Philippe as much. There was one other gal there whose name is Marty. She was really his right hand. I was probably second one helping him the most. I mean, she did a lot of the chemical analysis. I call myself a cellar rat. So I was steaming the barrels. I was doing a lot of washing. My hands were all cracked and, never could get enough lanolin on them, or they were purple or whatever. But I was absorbing a lot of what was going on. And, I mentioned tasting or blending, and Philippe would have 20 or 25 glasses in front of him of the barrels, deciding what would go into his blend. And so I was watching all of this. It was really great. I thought that's what I was going to do. And then some other opportunities came up, and I left the winery and went on to pursue other things. But it was a wonderful experience. And the Biltmore Estates, for those who have been there know how beautiful it is. And those who haven't been there yet, it is a beautiful, beautiful property. It was the landscape architect was Olmsted. It was his last work.
Awesome, yeah. Wow. I just looked it up online. It's amazing. It's stunning.
It's a 200-room French chateau in Asheville, North Carolina. And, going to work in the morning, you drive through these gates, and it was just like this so beautiful. I got interested in wine because my dad, he was working with a factory in Valence, France, is in the northern Rhône area. So it's really close to Hermitage, Saint-Joseph, Côte-Rôtie, Saint-Pré.
Those wonderful northern Rhône.
It's northern Rhône, Syrah-based wines, Marzahn for the whites. He would fly over every 3 or 4 weeks. At the time, you were allowed to carry liquids on plane. And so he had a 5-gallon jug that he would go to the winery and get filled and carry home. And he'd call us from the airport and say, get the bottles
cleaned
and the corks ready. So we'd bottle up this wine when he
That's
came back.
That's a great ritual.
Yeah, it was wonderful.
Welcome home, Dad.
Yeah, it was
perfect.
And so I just had that experience. It was nice. You know, for an American, that's not so common.
That's unusual.
And so I just got used to those wines. So my benchmark, consequently, for wines is the Northern Rhônes.
Well, and so, Joe, you're on exactly the opposite side of the equation, because from the wines that are produced, you are a curator as the owner of an inn, developing a remarkably broad wine cellar and learning about each of those wines in great detail so you could not only offer them to your patrons, but to talk about them, educate your patrons.
Yeah.
So what was that transition like for you from the financial world to this world of food and wine?
The financial world actually gave me quite a lot of opportunities to taste wines that I probably couldn't otherwise afford or whatever. So I think that was nice. But my interest in wine came through a father figure as well. Happened to be my father-in-law. My wife is French, and the very first time I went to Paris to meet him, we were in college, and he took us to lunch near his office. He took us to this restaurant called Chez Georges. I'll never forget it. And we had this amazing lunch, and he said, "Well, Joseph, would you have some wine?" And I said, "Well, man, I have some wine, Joe. I don't know much about wine." He goes, "I have a wine for you." And he ordered a Paul Jabalais Saint-Joseph, because his name was Joseph and my name was Joseph. He says, "Now, what are we going to have with this wine?" And then he steered me to the duck. So I had duck two ways, one with a sauce, one a confit. And that was the beginning. I'm like, this is amazing. The whole experience.
The
whole light bulb went on. And I remember towards the end of that lunch, he kind of touched my elbow and he says, "You know, Joseph," he says, "you do not need to drink the whole bottle." I'm like, "Oh, but I do." And he said, okay. And we shared many, many dinners together after that, whether it was here or...
What a great introduction.
And he had a little place in the south of France, quite near, in the Bandol Appellation, which is, again, this is how we come to our touchstones of what experience is. Like that wine, I didn't know what Tompier was, a famous Bandol. I didn't know anything about it, but he took me to meet Lulu, where he would buy 4 or 5 bottles a season of her wine. They'd known each other since after the war. So I have a soft spot for those wines. I have a soft spot for the Northern Rhône. And as I got into wine, I realized I had a soft spot for wine. I really like the whole aspect of the story. And so when I got to the inn, it was a chance to expand my horizon in terms of different areas. I never had any wines from Australia. I'd never had any wines from New Zealand. I still haven't had many wines from Germany. I don't know what that is, but I wish I had more experience with German wines, but through Italian wines and French wines. And of course, then, you know, wines of the Western world, which were really an afterthought for me. I didn't understand that there's a lot of great wine being made in our own country, in South America. It gave me an opportunity to learn a lot more. Because, as you say, I had to speak to what was on the list. I had this policy, and the salespeople, I'm sure, were not really that happy about it. I said, "I will be open to buy any wine that you bring me as long as I can taste it first." I was not going to buy anything based on what someone said it was going to be or whatever. No, let's open a bottle and see how it shows. And because you can tell a lot, like, okay, well, wine might be great, but it can't be on the list in its state right now, in its young state. No one's going to enjoy this wine. So am I willing to buy it and sit on it for 10 years or 5 years?
And
there was
you?
Always that. Some. But mostly I was trying to manage for like what's going to be on the list for my clients and what am I going to be proud to talk to them about.
And you did wine tastings as well.
We did like these big wine dinners, we used to call them. And,
nice.
And had lots of funny and great personalities from the wine world coming in, whether they were in distribution or whether at the winery themselves. And we had a really amazing kitchen with a great cadre of chefs, and they and I would look forward to putting these dinners together because it was something completely different from the menu.
And totally creative.
Totally creative. And it, to the point of even like tweaking little dishes here and there to make sure they were going to show great with the wines that night. So we did a lot of those. We were doing 7 of those special dinners a year.
It's a big undertaking.
It's a big undertaking, but it was also, it put Wyndham Hill on the map in many ways. People were coming to us for the wine list. They were coming to us for the kitchen, as well as the beautiful 160 acres and this little farmhouse. You know, so it was a great experience, and I've enjoyed every minute of it.
The cumulative knowledge and discernment that you each bring to the conversation is the big gift to those who are listening, because then we get to benefit from the experiences that you've gleaned over these years of trying different wines and learning about them and being so discerning.
The road is long. I have a lot more to discover.
Yeah. Looking at the Cahors wine, it's a Malbec grape. Came about because a friend was recently visiting from France and began to wax poetic around an amazing dish, a traditional French dish in the countryside called cassoulet. And the wine that goes with cassoulet is the beautiful, deep, complex Cahors wine. And that is what made us think, well, why don't we try for our first show to look at the Cahors wine? And it's a great topic because none of us have any experience with this wine, like virtually at all. So we've got, I think, five or six wines that we're ready to taste. And I'm going to introduce briefly the people who you will be hearing talking about the wine. Joe Canini, Larry Burdick, and Keith Zimmerman. Among the four of us, we're going to have a little exploration of Cahors wines. And I'd like to, first of all, start off by looking at, so what is this cassoulet that made it so important for us to understand the Cahors wines that married so beautifully with this dish? Larry, have you made cassoulet?
It's a delicious, hearty dish. Often it's served in a bowl with a little chapelure on top of it, and they grill the top before you serve it. But I guess I would call it I don't want to call it a stew or a ragu or a potage, but it's, you know, a winter dish, one mm-hmm. might say.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yes, it definitely had all the attributes.
A lot of garlic.
That. Yes, yes, yes.
And also there's a little saucisson de Toulouse usually in, which is a very garlicky, delicious sausage.
We got on the trail of this because of this friend. What was his name?
Julien.
Oh, Julien. Yes, yeah. He was just, you know, so enamored with this dish. His grandmother would make it, right, in Cahors. So we sourced these white beans, these cannellini beans that were grown right here in Vermont, actually, and local, organic, and we got the pork belly, the lamb, and the pork tenderized by roasting it in the oven. We had duck confit. Keith, I think you contributed the duck confit. It just went on and on. There were so many ingredients and so deep and earthy, like the whole dish was so earthy. So maybe that brings us to thinking about what kind of wine naturally goes with such an amazing dish.
The exact ingredients changes from person to person, really. But the spirit of the dish seems to be always the same. Probably the white beans is the most consistent, and garlic, yeah.
Garlic and the pork belly and the pancetta or something. I mean, there's those deepening flavors in the bottom of the bowl.
We're talking about a wine that needs to be substantive, because otherwise it can't stand up.
It
to
has to have
a
muscle
dish like that.
Right, right, exactly.
Real power.
So, Joe, tell us what you've learned about Malbec.
Well, I learned in this area of France, Malbec is actually called different things. It's called Côte. It's called Auxerrois. It's a grape that's used throughout much of France. Certainly it's used in Bordeaux as one of 5 or 7 varietals that go into a Bordeaux blend. And it was often used to impart color and body. So known as the black wine since medieval times, Malbec or Côte, as it was known then, has become really important in the history of French winemaking. It was very sought after. In fact, was shipped back to the Russian royal court via England. And I want to talk about shipping at some point, because I think it's a really important part of...
Yeah, I was fascinated by this part of the history. Yeah.
Yeah, but I think it was often a wine used for ceremonial purposes in the Orthodox Church. Again, it was known as that of the black wine. And so it was very distinctive.
That part I didn't know. That's interesting. You know, in that region of Cahors, it was originally settled by the Celts. And then when it was overcome by the Romans, and there were these trade routes that were established between there through Bordeaux and back to England. And then from there, it was transported to Russia, and it became like the wine to have, that black wine in Russia. And maybe it's because of that affiliation with the Russian Orthodox Church.
Yeah, and they copied it. The Moldovan wine industry is very much based on a varietal that mimics Malbec. So Georgian wine is incredibly rich, like it was, and has tons of fruit in it. It's gone further around the globe, this grape, than you would imagine.
It's interesting to note that this was traveling throughout Europe and into Russia in the 12th and 13th centuries. Like, that's the part that just blew my mind, that this grape has been so foundational to the trade among these different territories all throughout Europe and Eastern Europe. Let's talk about the attributes of this wine, this black wine that dates now from centuries back. It has a very, very deep and earthy undertone to its whole taste profile. You know, maybe it would be a good time to pour out one of the first wines we have.
Well, it was, you know, the thing when we decided to do this show with the Cahors, it's not an easy wine to find. This one happened to come from Brattleboro, and it's called the Combelle La Serre. It's a 2022 vintage. This is the second wine of this particular house, so it's not the reserve wine, and it's, my guess is it's made for earlier consumption, not a wine that needs to age for a long, long time.
But let me ask you about that, because it does say that some of the Cahors wines, they could be aged like from now until 2030, for example, right? So now we're going to open up a bottle that's 2022, so maybe a little young. This bottle is certainly less than $20 a bottle. I think it's around $16 or $17 a bottle. Which is one of the things that we're super interested in exploring in this show, are wines that are cost efficient, that they deliver excellent value, excellent taste, excellent profile, and yet they don't cost the earth.
I was to go back in the history of Cahors a little bit, because Cahors, what used to be 80,000 hectares, that was the largest wine growing area in France in the Middle Ages, and really was that large up, I think it peaked at the 80,000 in 1880-ish is when that much land was under vine. Towards the end of that, there was a phylloxera attacked the vines in France, and it literally wiped out all the Malbec in the Cahors area. Some cuttings went to Argentina. That's one of the reasons why you see so much Malbec from Argentina and why there's so little in the Cahors. They had a long time trying to revive their viticulture there. It got an AOC designation, I think, in
82, I want to say, but maybe even later.
I've got 71.
Okay.
So yeah. 1971, it received an AOC designation.
And that really coincided with the area making a decent comeback from both, well, two things. It was phylloxera in the late 1800s, and then an incredibly severe frost in 1956, which is, you know, sort of in the annals of French winemaking, where so many of the crops were totally wiped out, and so it was a replanting exercise once again. But I find it interesting that this area is so incredibly protective of what it had historically. They have resisted all commercial pushes to move into Chardonnay or Cabernet Sauvignon. There are historical reasons, I think, for that, too. There was this long-running hegemony of Bordeaux as a city, and I always tell people who are interested in wine, if you really want to know where good wine regions might be, just follow the rivers, right? Follow the rivers in any given country, and if you get the right soil and you have rivers, you're likely to find vineyards. Their vineyards are upstream of the ocean, and Bordeaux being on the ocean. But those rivers, the Lot and Garonne rivers, the Lot River in the case of Cahors, flowed into Bordeaux, and there was actually different kingdoms at one point in France that complicated matters. In Cahors' case, they were actually, their wines were prevented from using Bordeaux as an exit port until all the serious reds from Bordeaux had been sold for the year.
See, it pays to be a gate city to the ocean. You can control all
they
trade.
Totally, and Bordeaux did control all that trade. These people in Cahors were either late, or if they wanted to get their wine somewhere early, it was across the Pyrenees. There weren't a lot of options. That's one of the reasons I think they've become so fiercely protective of what it is they have.
Well, also they have a wine that has a very unique characteristic to it as well. And one thing that I was struck by it was through this initiative, the pre-phylloxera, where there were cuttings that were sent out and sort of broadcast throughout the world, Argentina, South Africa, Australia, California. And it was after that devastating blight that France was able to sort of call back some of those original plantings and revitalize the entire winemaking industry, which was an extraordinary undertaking.
Yeah, for the most part, they were, and here in the States too, the most vinifera grapes are grafted to an American rootstock, which is resistant to the phylloxera.
It's remarkable,
pest.
Actually.
Yeah, pest. It's a pest.
Yes, so. This pas de deux between, you know, the various countries in France in order to revitalize the entire winemaking industry. But then when you think about the change that happened with the Malbec and the style of winemaking after that frost, the wines became less sharp-edged, less tannic, not soft, but maybe a little bit rounder. We have two wines that we're tasting at the moment, De Combelle La Serre, Cahors, which is a 2022. And then we opened another bottle. It's a Cahors from Odile Delpont, and that is a 2020. So, Larry, what are you tasting?
I'm surprised that the alcohol content is so reasonable. What do you think, Joe Keith? The reason for that would be, is that a stylistic choice being made by winemakers? Is there a climate thing going on there, a microclimate?
I bet they could get it riper if they wanted. I just think it's proximity to Bordeaux. It's not that far away. The accepted 13 and 13.5 Bordeaux marker is probably being observed by winemakers there.
That first one is 12.5. That surprised me.
Yeah.
It's lovely.
It's got a really great flavor, yeah.
But I'm also hoping that it's going to open up a little bit more in the glass, that it has just a little bit around the edges. It feels like it needs to soften.
The tannins are pretty firm.
I looked in my Larousse of Wines and looked up Cahors. It's a book from the early 70s. In there, they were saying Cahors wines were recommended that they spend 3, 4, 5 years in a cask and then be bottled afterwards and then spend another 3 or 4 years before being drunk. That's what was being recommended by some people back in those days. These are very young.
They do taste young, but they're lively without being like overly fruit forward. I mean, if that's one way to describe it. But I'm wondering, in one of the sites where I was doing research, it says the top priority for the Malbec is usually tannin management. Keith, what does that mean? How do you, what is tannin management?
Well, the tannin is sort of like if you were chewing on a piece of wood. Tannin in this case, it's in the skin or the stems. That's why they de-stem a lot of red grapes and they don't ferment with the stems. So maybe you don't use new wine barrels. You know, you use used wine barrels or a larger foudre or a larger tank, or maybe you ferment in cement or you ferment in stainless steel and you just stay away from adding any more woody character to the wines at all. Larry was getting at these long aging process, the tannins over time will soften. That's why you would age these wines for a long time.
Well, you know, they also said that the grapes are often destemmed, although they will keep some bunches of grape on the stem, and maybe it's to calibrate that amount of tannin.
That's the winemaker's art.
Right.
That's really the winemaker's art.
It's the alchemy.
No kidding.
What do they want to do, and do they crush the grapes and let them macerate with the skins for however long? When do they add the yeast? Do they add the yeast immediately and get the fermentation started?
Then you usually have, even if they do it in these cement, like more inert containers for their initial fermentations, you end up with lots of juice with lots of skins and maybe not stems, but maybe on top, and they call that a cap. And there's all kinds of management techniques for the relationship between that juice and that cap. And sometimes they punch down the cap, sometimes they pump wine from the bottom and let it go over it again. And that all comes into tannin management and flavor extraction.
When you say inert, you're talking about a cask like steel? Steel
Either
tanks
steel or
as
cement.
Opposed to
cement,
the
cement
oak.
And,
the
I think
French
cement
oak.
And steel would be the two basic.
There was another term that I came across, pigeage, which is the punch down. Is that what you were just describing, Joe? And this is part of this new approach to the aging of this wine. They're aging in concrete and amphora, and the winemakers are arguing that the amphora actually encourages a more pure expression of the Malbec. It's considered sort of across the board that the Malbecs being made today are the best expression of the Malbecs, hands down. Like, in other words, there's been this
in the cohort, you mean?
Yes, in the cohort, yeah.
I think Argentinians might take a little, because they're stylistically just a little bit different. I find them to be generally softer wines. I find the cohort to be slightly more robust. You know, one thing that this has that I don't think you'd find in an Argentinian Malbec is this has the Southern French garrigue, you know, that people talk about all the time. It's just around the edges of this wine you get that.
Yeah.
Because these vines will go right up to wherever the mountain starts, and usually that's pine forest, that's got rosemary growing thyme growing wild.
Yeah.
And so that is what they call that garrigue, that transitioning place between the vines and then the forest. Lots of scents.
Lovely description.
Yeah, lots of scents. And I find that in this wine.
I find it particularly in the second one.
The second one is immediately accessible. I've got some like raspberry and violet, and less tannic than the first, which is changing even now as it sits in the glass.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think the second one is nice. That second wine gives us an opportunity to talk about négociant wines, which is a way of showcasing smaller properties that would never produce enough on their own to become a major seller, exporter.
Is that what the second wine is?
Yeah, it's a négociant wine, and the négociant is a young woman named Mary Taylor. She's worked in vineyards all over France and South America as well. She has an amazing stable of small, hard-to-find, underrepresented wines in the world that she's put together under one umbrella. And that's what négociants do. They support by buying the production of small producers, those producers, and they might help them package and get import license or export licenses for them, etc.
Do you mean like a Louis Jadot
in
Louis Burgundy and Louis maybe Jadot on a bigger scale?
This Mary Taylor wine, this is...
Well, it's sort of immediately accessible.
Yeah.
The first one's coming around in the glass.
Yeah, and it's so amazing to me how the taste of the wine can change so dramatically. So we've just poured a third wine, and before we talk about it, I just want to take this opportunity to mention again that you're listening to WOOL 91.5 FM radio.
You know, before we go on, Cynthia, I just want to come back to that concept of the second versus the first wine. We're all finding it's a little brighter, it's fruit forward, etc. That's the Mary Taylor, 100% fermented and aged in stainless steel, does not see any wood whatsoever.
Interesting.
So that's an interesting fun fact. Because oftentimes...
Because you can taste it.
It's just pure, you know, it's sort of purity of fruit, not muddied up by any wood. So maybe that's part of what we're tasting.
Well, at the same time, that first wine is definitely, it's gaining character. And it's losing a little bit of that astringent edge to it. So the wine that we've just poured... Is Larry, can you see the label? What is it that we're going to taste now?
Chateau Les Eaux d'Aglon, 2019.
So a little bit more age on it.
It's a core. This one has the European biological symbol on the label.
I have to say, it's definitely a step up. That's a lovely bottle of wine. That has an approachability. It's really round to me.
Well, they have such a good writer at this distributor, and they were talking about... aromas of dried plums and brandied cherries and fresh forest mushrooms.
I thought he was exaggerating and using hyperbole, but maybe not, now that I'm tasting it.
Well, especially as it comes up to temperature as well, because I think it's a little chilled. Yeah, it's very interesting. So we have three wines in front of us, different characteristics, based not only on the age, but also on, of course, the vintner, but this foundational similarity that's running through, which is the characteristics of this grape.
Cynthia, you mentioned earlier prices. I think all of these are maybe under $20. I'm not sure.
Or thereabouts.
I do feel as though the Malbec is so right for pairing with food that has a lot of soul and a lot of deep flavors to it.
Winter food.
Yeah,
definitely.
Winter food. And you can almost feel that just from the region that it comes from, the Cahors, which is sort of in the center of France, north of Toulouse, just to the east of Bordeaux. There's a earthiness there. There's, you know, when they talk about terroir relative to wines, there is this intrinsic connection between, like, the geology of the land, the quality of the land, the culture of the land, and the expression of the land through the grape. And I feel like this is something we're tasting right here as well.
And these three wines are very different.
Yeah.
The first one to this last one we're trying. To me, this last one, it's still very tight You know, it's not opened up and fragrant. I think it.
I'm glad you said that.
To me, I agree. It could use more time in the bottle.
Yeah.
Even though it's older than the other two.
My taste. And the distributor says drink it now or through 2030. So it was really meant to be in the bottle now for a little bit longer.
It's showing that the tannin is still quite strong in that wine, which is not a surprise. I mean, this is Malbec. The other two grapes that are allowed in the Cahora area are Tanat and Merlot. So those are the three grapes that are allowed in that AOC area. But
nonetheless, there has to be at least 70% of Malbec in the wine.
Yeah. But those grapes used to soften, I think, more than anything else, don't you think?
Right, but Tanat's also very astringent.
Yeah,
great. So the Merlot would be the one that's probably carrying the water. These are wines that Cynthia and Joe and Larry and I have not had, and it's an area of France that we're not that familiar with. I've had Cahors over the years, but very few. So it's really fun for us.
It's kind of an area that gets overlooked, and I think that's one of the fun things of doing these programs. We can explore as well as showing the way for hopefully a lot of other people who want to just learn a little bit about wine. It's a fun exploration. I'm really excited that although it is a region where the wines are harder to find, we're able to put together five or six around the table in fairly short order, and it's a reasonable place to look if you're looking for kind of an everyday bottle of wine.
The search was fun.
Now, did you bring the Eulalie?
I did.
So this is a 2012, so it's going to be 10 years older than the first wine that we opened, right? So I just poured a little bit in your glass if you want to give that a taste. So that would bring us to four very, very different Malbecs, I think, to be tasting all in one flight here.
Oh, I just wanted to mention, Keith and Joe just pointed out, we found four or five of these in the area. If you're outside that region of France, even around France, I haven't seen a lot of Cahors. I mean, you really got to look for them.
Also, you know, when you travel and you find yourself in these sort of pockets of France or Italy, and there are wines that are made there regionally that are mostly employed regionally. Therefore, the people that live there and work there and cook their own food.
The cassoulet.
And cook the cassoulet. God bless them, you know.
Eat foie gras. Yes.
Oh, and that's something else that we were going to mention, the cheeses that might go with this. There, so we have some sharp cheeses, like a sheep's milk cheese from northern Spain. They also mentioned that maybe a blue cheese would be interesting to go with this wine because the depth and the edge of this wine is so pronounced.
I think Roquefort is from this area.
It could be, yes, Roquefort.
Roquefort is from this area, yeah. Just find the foods that they make there, and typically speaking, those are the foods that go with the wine almost anywhere in the world.
Right. But it's a good profile of, you know, very hearty country cheese, something that has a little bit of a bite to it, you know, a little bit of an edge to it.
Yeah.
And there it is. It's the perfect marriage with the type of wine as well. So when we made the cassoulet, we layered the bottom with port belly, and then we put in layers of the cooked beans. We put in layers of the lamb sausage with garlic, then layer of beans, the duck confit. I mean, it just was layering protein and beans with plenty of garlic.
And beautiful stock.
And then that beautiful, beautiful mushroom stock. It was an elegant dish. We think about cassoulet as being this, you know, from the depths of the country kind of a dish. And Larry, as you had mentioned earlier, everyone does their own version of cassoulet depending on what's from the garden and what's in the refrigerator. But this was a mighty, mighty dish. And the Malbec was perfection.
Larry, do you think that when people commit to making a cassoulet, because it's a commitment, it takes some time, is it more of a special occasion to mark things? Do you think it's that kind of dish in these, although it is kind of a peasant dish, I would say it's kind of one of the kings of the peasant dishes, just because of the time, the number of ingredients.
It's considered a peasant dish, Joe, as you said. But in the old days, people had more time.
Yeah, that's true.
And people lived on farms, and people had access to all those ingredients. You mentioned the stock. The stock is so important. Not everybody has access to lamb or duck or good sausages.
Yeah, actually, Julien, the young Frenchman who was visiting here, said that his grandmother and grandparents who were from south of the city of Cahors, and just a tiny little village, Larry, it looked like there were maybe 10 buildings in the little village. I mean, a speck. And Julien said his grandmother, when we made the cassoulet here, he's with the duck and everything, and Julien says, my grandmother never had duck. You know, it was just we were poor farmers,
we had what
they raised.
And of course, this is a dish where you use some of the parts of the animal that maybe require long and slow cooking, and then you get that really deep, beautiful flavor out of the dish. So we've poured the fourth wine. It's the Eulalie 2012, 12.5% alcohol. So again, it's very, very light. There's this beautiful light quality to it in terms of the alcohol, but the flavor and the berry quality, I think, is lovely and pronounced.
Is anybody else getting this like herbal eucalyptus type herb?
Yeah, that's
that's a bad thing.
No,
either,
it's like a top note.
It's a top note. It's a minty mm-hmm. sort of
thing. Minty, mm-hmm. Yeah,
minty. Yeah,
they're really nice.
Like often you find in a Bordeaux.
Yeah,
is that true? Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I often find that eucalyptic minty taste.
Yeah,
tasting.
Exactly. Yeah,
yeah, or Napa Cabernet will
have that as well.
Can also have it.
Now, see, that's interesting because minty is not necessarily an adjective that one would ascribe to wine.
Well, no, and really the eucalyptus was the better descriptor than mint.
Yeah, it's lovely. But, you know, it's also a contrivance for that very, very rounded flavor to the whole thing. There's a rounded taste profile to the wine, and that gives it the top.
The vocabulary of tasting is always approximative.
Yes.
And different people find different ways of expressing it. Yeah.
You know, one thing when you were talking earlier, Keith, about the size of Cahors, I mean, this is a very, very small region. And what I had found was that there's, I think, 7,500 acres total that are under cultivation right now for the Malbec grape, which is, you know, in the grand scheme of things, it is a very, very small parcel of land that is responsible for carrying forward this entire legacy of Malbec winemaking in France. But what I've discovered in some of this, you know, travel that I've done in France and different parts of Europe, it is so surprising how small the regions are for the amazing reputations they carry, for the quality of wine that they produce. And when you get there, you think, oh my goodness, is this Chateau Neuf du Pape? You know, I mean, it's just a crossroads, right? It's Margaux is a crossroads. In the middle of vineyards that extend in every direction. And it's just by way of saying the things that we find so exceptional in this world are often things that are done in small production levels, artisanally, by hand, with careful oversight. And the wines, I think, are just such a beautiful expression of that. And even though they have such grand reputations, really every bottle that you open is, for the most part, a bottle that has been husbanded and carefully watched over.
And it's so often the case, especially in smaller regions, where the wines have been made by the same families on the same parcels for hundreds of years.
Yes.
Hats off to tradition.
Yeah.
There are a number of women winemakers who are just doing exceptional work, and they are the next generation inheriting that legacy of generations-owned vineyards.
That's one of the things I really liked about this Mary Taylor. It's a young woman who's really blazing a trail, because there aren't a lot of women négociants that I've come across, and I really like what she's doing, because she is championing these off-the-beaten-track wines.
Oh, I see. So Mary Taylor is the négociant. Yes.
Yeah, and the vineyard. Excellent. And the family making the wine is on the label as well.
Yes,
and
that is Odile Depont.
Yeah, and yeah. Odile was the grandmother, and Didier Pellevin is her grandson, and he is the one who is in charge of the estate and the wines now.
The role of the négociant is also huge in terms of how these wines find their way. I mean, in the very beginning of this discussion, we were talking about the Cahors finding its way finally through Bordeaux up to England, where it could be then ultimately shared with the world. So fast forward 800, 1,000 years, and here we are with the négociants, whose role is to do that very job.
It is to do that very job. Luckily, all the constraints of shipping through Bordeaux ended with the French Revolution. And there were no more kingdoms, no more dukes, Dutch judges, none of that stuff. That was done.
That's right. What would be the attributes, Keith, that you would most look for if you were a winemaker in Malbec?
That's a question I don't know how to answer, because I don't know the grape well enough. You've got to go out in the vineyard and taste these berries as they're maturing and deciding when to pick. You know, are you going to use the indigenous yeast that's in the vineyard and go a natural process? It's every individual would be different in terms of how they would try to put those wines together. And then the blend, are you going to use, 70% Malbec and 20% Tannat and 10% Merlot? Or
They had said at one point that there was only a 4 or 5 day window for actually picking the grapes for this particular grape, the Malbec, that the window was very narrow. Is that typically the case, or is it, do you know about that relative to the cultivation?
I don't think it's that exact. I mean, here's a winemaker himself who talks about it. I mentioned Didier Pevelin, who runs the vineyard that Mary Taylor represents. At the end, he said, quote, "I like to go into vineyards on Sunday night when it is quiet to smell the vineyard and think about the level of maturity." That says a lot about
how
winemakers approach it in yes. various places, especially yes. a winemaker who looks after 52 hectares in a region that used to have 48,000 hectares of Cahors under vine.
You know, I just was thinking when we were talking about the dedication of the winemakers and what makes a wine taste good, I notice often, without trying to sound trendy, organic wines and biodynamic wines, I enjoy them more and find they have deeper, cleaner flavors. I think that might be an important thing here, too.
That's excellent. I
think there might be only one here tonight, but as I explore, when I'm in France, I drink more natural biodynamic wines and organic wines. I'm finding I like them more. There's less off flavors.
Do you know, that's so interesting to hear, because the recently I was traveling in France with family members, and there was one who refused to get any biodynamic wines because he proclaimed that they had a muddy quality to them. And I actually agree with you. I think that the tastes happen to be cleaner, less encumbered in some way, and I don't quite know how to describe it, but the flavors are more accessible. And the other part of it is that it is simply the right thing to do. You know, it is right to grow anything that we grow in an environmentally appropriate way, right?
There is controversy, however, especially in the natural wines, which takes even biodynamic farming a step further, where you just don't add anything, you don't do anything. You take the grape juice and you ferment it. Often they do have problems, and often they're not very good, or often they can't age. And I get that. There's a little revolution or exciting new thing going on, I noticed, in France, where there's tons of young people getting into winemaking, just trying everything. And it's kind of exciting. So you taste natural wines that are like, oh my God, that's an expression of earth, fruit, and heaven. And then you drink another one, you say, oh my God, that's undrinkable. And so there's a lot going on now in that regard.
Yeah, it's good. It's a good way of experimentation, because it's the right path. And it also harkens back to that artisanal quality that we were talking about a few minutes ago.
And more people are going organic and biodynamic in France, I notice. A lot of them don't mention it. You don't even know it. You know, we made a point earlier about tasting wines. Sometimes I buy a bottle, and if it's something I'm trying to get familiar with and know whether I want to buy more, I drink it over 3 or 4 days. Yeah.
And that's good.
And that's a real test, too, of what the wine is like and how it was made often. There's exceptions to every thought now, and every experiment.
I agree with that.
Can you describe, though, a little bit in more detail? So over 3 or 4 days, what information is coming forward?
Often it's just getting better and more complex, Cynthia. Mm. Often.
And sometimes it gets thinner and just sort of doesn't hold up.
Fades away.
Goes to vinegar.
Yeah, I mean, you know, quickly.
Larry, I was going to try to ask you, thinking about the Burgundy wine, the profile of that wine, and tasting these Malbecs, are there ways that you could characterize some of the differences? Is that a fair question?
Very fair question, yep. You know, there's so many different styles in Burgundy itself. Sometimes I find when you taste Bordeaux's, it's very clear that it's a Bordeaux or not. And that might just be me, the way I taste things. And often in Burgundy, there's plenty of room to say, oh, isn't that interesting? That could be maybe be this, you know, a Pinot Noir from the Loire or something from the Jura. The Mâcon region now, I'm in love with because there's so many great, great Chardonnays from there that are so affordable. And they're really delicious. You guys probably agree with me.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. Yeah.
And I've always loved Beaujolais wines, the Gamay grape. And in Beaujolais, which was known as this mass producer of table wine, it wasn't always good and heavily polluted with pesticides. There's a sort of a revolution going on there now. Tons of young people are there trying to make great artisanal wines that are clean. And so the choices now of things to get out of Beaujolais are so much greater than they used to be.
It's also, there's a kind of a trend. I think a Beaujolais wine was given a very bad rap maybe 10, 15 years ago, and now all of a sudden it's au courant again.
Well, I think the thing about Beaujolais is it is a pretty big area. They produce a lot of wine from the Beaujolais Nouveau to all the way to what they would call the Cru Beaujolais or the Monopole Beaujolais, which are just individual villages usually that sit on higher ground and have made age-worthy Beaujolais wines for years. And they are Fleury, Julianas, Moulin Vent, and Saint-Amour and others. But I think there's 7 of them or something like that. But I would highly recommend that as a very pleasurable, near Burgundian kind of experience. And the proximity to Beaujolais is southern.
Sounds like that's something for another show.
It could be. Yeah, it could be another
Larry.
Show.
Cynthia.
Yes. That's a great segue to the next show, maybe.
Right. So we're going to have to wrap it up in just a few minutes, but I was going to ask wanted to just do one more tasting through of the 4 wines that we have in front of us, 22, 2020, 2019, and 2012, I think, are the 4 wines. In my view, they each have changed to some degree in the glass. The younger wines, maybe not quite as much as the ones that are a little bit more aged. And while we organize that last tasting, I just want to say again to remind you all that we're listening to WOOL 91.5 FM. Is there any wine here that you would want to open to have at your table this evening?
Before I get into the wines I prefer, the color of these wines.
It's beautiful.
I mean, they're all about essentially the same. Sometimes, you know, you get in some areas and the wines will be a different color, but these are this deep garnet red. It's gorgeous. Even the older one, the 2012, sometimes older wines might turn a little brick color, but these are all just beautiful, dark black.
These are the black wines.
We've come full circle.
Yeah, right, and they're just a lovely, lovely color.
Yeah, deep garnet, really beautiful, very, very beautiful. Yeah. Well, I have to say, I'm really appreciating the Eulalie, and I could imagine cooking all manner of wonderful main dishes to go with this particular wine. I think it's lovely and nuanced.
Yeah, I think these wines need food.
Yes.
They beg to have food.
They're designed to be consumed with food, yeah.
We may want to eat some meals with these wines and come back and comment on them in the future. Who knows? Joe, your point in mind, it really would change the experience of tasting them.
Well, so in summary, we have just out of the several more bottles that we brought to the table, we only opened four. It was plenty in terms of getting this beautiful profile of wines over a 10 or 12 year stretch, and a very, very interesting inquiry into the Malbec.
Yeah, for me, none of these wines are disappointing. No. I think they're all really lovely. Quite lovely, different. Mm. The first one to me is very bright and friendly, just friendly little wine.
It is. It's very approachable.
Yeah. The one from the Negociant, whose name I don't
Mary
recall.
Taylor.
Mary Taylor.
Mary Taylor, yeah.
Has sort of it's a little bit of a caramel.
I know what you mean.
It's a little,
Like burnt honey, something.
Something like that.
Yeah.
It's a good thing.
Yes.
And it's all stainless steel,
yeah,
right?
It's good,
there's
right.
No,
so
it's really interesting.
Nice, yeah.
I'm wondering if that one went all the way with the Merlot, the full 30%. I'm wondering.
100% Malbec.
That is
100% Malbec, stainless steel. But here's the difference. The soil.
Oh.
Clay over limestone.
Uh-huh.
And I think that's generally speaking the soil types you're going to find in Gaoa because of the uplift in where the geology of the area works. But I do find, as I taste wines, that any time I find that this clay and decent representation in the terroir, you're going to get a very fruit-forward, bright red fruit expression, and that's what I get in the Mary
Taylor
wine.
That is so interesting. Yeah. I love that direct connection to the soil and the geology.
That's great, Joe.
And you can taste, you know, it's amazing. You can taste that. One can taste that in a bottle of wine.
If we get to do a show on one of my favorite areas, the Willamette Valley of Oregon, because of geologic major movements, there exist both volcanic soils, predominantly volcanic soils, and predominantly clay soils in different, very close, proximate areas. So these wines can be wildly different that are only 10 miles apart. Both excellent, very different flavor profiles. So
I hope we get a chance to do an exploration of the Willamette.
That sounds like Burgundy, Joe.
It is.
Where
it is just
where
like Burgundy.
1 meter away, something changed in the wine.
Right. Mm. Or Italy, yeah, same thing. Yeah.
So what are you thinking, Larry? What are you tasting?
I'm just thinking the oldest. It's still a delight to drink, but you can see how much the fruit flavors have subsided. The fruit has been very, very mellowed.
Well, and
I don't speak as an expert, just someone who drinks wine, by the way.
Well, that's all of us. We're not experts.
Wait a minute. I just want to say, Joe, you've been a sommelier and a very fine collector, and Keith's been a winemaker. I was a cellar rat.
I was not a winemaker.
I always defer to you guys on. And Joe, you've just mentioned a ton of interesting things tonight: history, geology.
It's all a beautiful puzzle, I think, wine, and it defines cultures. It defines certainly countries and habits. You know, it defines how people live.
So with that, maybe we can just end by saying: here we've just explored an entire region of France. Every single bottle was less than $20 a bottle. And it is a grape well worth exploring, the Malbec from Cahors. We hope that you have a chance to taste them yourselves. The music for What's My Wine was composed by Keith Zimmerman, produced by T. Skoll, with Peter Stoley on accordion, Ashok Agarwal on bass, Scott Shetler on clarinet, and Keith Zimmerman on guitar. To find this episode and other archived episodes online, please visit whatsmywineradio.com. There you will find the labels of the wines we are tasting in this program and information about the region, the terroir, and the vintners. This is a production of What's My Wine Radio out of Walpole, New Hampshire. Until the next wine, thank you for listening.